Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for putting this meeting together and for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to present my research. My name is Alex Kulakov. I'm basically, this is a highly photoshopped the version of the environment that. So I'm going to talk about brain and neuroscience, and I realize that not many of you, some of you may not familiar with the brain, so I'll just give you a brief introduction about it, how the brain works. This is a very basic scheme. So the basic element of the brain is neuron, of course. Neuron has, it's a highly polarized cell. As a normal cell, it has a cell body with nucleus, but also it has a lot of processes that help process the information. So, for example, it has dendrites that are receptacles of information from other neurons, so the electrical potentials can travel on the dendrites as passive waveguides. And then the cell at some point makes, on the basis of this integrated information from the dendrites, the cell makes the decision to generate something that is called action potential, which is a very brief, a few millisecond long change in the membrane voltage that then can propagate along axon. And then when it arrives at the synapses, which are contacts with other cells, the action potential, or spike, also sometimes called, can induce a release of neurotransmitter from the synapse. The neurotransmitter will diffuse to another cell and will activate another cell. And that's how information propagates along the network of the brain. So, of course, human cortex has about 10 billion neurons, and each neuron makes about 10 to the fourth synapses. So the question is, how is it possible to specify all these connections with the limited amount of space in the genome? This is just the coronal section through the brain that shows that cortex is a highly convoluted contains a highly convoluted gray matter. Gray matter, actually the medium that contains the neurons themselves, the cell bodies, and also a lot of connections that are not myelinated. And the connections, the white matter, are mostly connections that are covered with dielectric sheaths that makes the pulses, the spikes propagate faster. So the point which I'm trying to make here is that from the first approximation, you can think of cortex as a two-dimensional medium, because the properties of the cells that I'm going to discuss, they don't change much over the thickness of the cortex. So the first thing which strikes everyone who starts studying neuroscience is are the maps. So this is one of the examples of the maps, which is map of topography. In this case, it's in the mouse visual cortex. So the mouse visual cortex is located on the back, as well as ours. It's located on the back of the heads. And what you can see here is a color representation of the vertical position in the outside world. So if the stimulus is placed in this place somewhere, it will activate neurons in this area. And similarly, there is also a representation of the horizontal coordinate in the same area of the cortex. So there is basically a little miniature TV screen that is that you can find in the brains of many species, and you can actually find several TV screens. Like this is a primary visual cortex, and this would be a smaller visual cortices. So, and of course, this is extremely strange phenomenon, because you can think that if there is a TV screen, somebody must be watching it. So you can start thinking about homunculi, maybe observing the environment, but I'll try to provide some argument why you may find those features. So another example of cortical map, the ocular dominance map. It turns out that in the brains of monkeys and cats and dogs, projections from two eyes converge on the same area. So you would have, in our brains, for example, in our primary visual cortex, left and right eye dominated neurons would converge. And then there is a problem of how do you form the pattern. And this is how this is solved. So there is the zebra skin-like pneumatic liquid crystal that is formed, and the black areas here are representing the areas that are dominated by the left eye, and white are the right eye. This is interesting feature here, where there is no left eye neurons, and the idea here is that this is part of the visual field that corresponds to the gaze directed at the nose of the animal. So this is actually the shadow of the nose. There is no left eye neurons in this direction, and this is the optic disc through which neurons are leaving the eye. So there is no right eye neurons there. So another higher order representation that is found in the same exactly area of the cortex, the primary visual cortex, is the so-called orientation preference map. And the idea here is that neurons, they respond to edges. They respond to edges in the visual world, and for every neuron, almost for every neuron, there is a preferred edge at which it will respond most vigorously. And this is the position, this is this preferred edge for the neurons in this point in the cortex are shown by the bar, by the white bars, and also by color map. And as you can see, the edges, preferred orientation of the edge changes mostly smoothly across the surface of the cortex, with occasional singularities, which are negative and positive discriminations, also called in this field, for some reason, pinwheels. So my approach to this problem is basically to start from the ground up and try to understand how the most primitive maps are formed, and then to try to understand maybe higher order maps. So I will begin by telling you a story about how the topographic maps are formed in actually subcortical area. So this is the problem is, so this is a representation of the retina. And there are about 1 million cells from the retina. So retina has about 1 megapixel. It sends about 1 million projections to the superior colliculus of the midbrain. And the projections, these projections are arranged topographically. So there is a representation, TV screen-like representation of the outside world and the superior colliculus. And it turns out that the coordinate system in the retina is set up by the gradient of a certain protein, of expression of some certain protein that is called EPHA. There are actually several proteins in this family, and I'm just showing you the net level of expression. And the recipient coordinate system for the horizontal coordinate in the eye is set up by the protein that is called EphrinA. And EphrinA is a ligand for EPHA, so it can bind and activate EPHA. And well, you can surmise from just layout of this map that neurons that have high level of expression of EPHA will be repelled by the high levels of EphrinA. So there is this chemotaxis that happens when the axons arrive to the superior colliculus. They will start moving around, and then they will find their best spot according to the levels of labels.
You're talking about development, right?
Yeah. This is, there is a perpendicular axis. Amazingly, this is actually the Cartesian, there is a Cartesian system of coordinates in the eye. So there is a vertical axis, the dorsoventral axis is set up by yet another protein, which is called EPHB. And it has this also a gradient of expression that is matched by the gradient of expression of the ligand for EPHB. And from the layout of the map, you can surmise that there's an attractive interaction between levels, between axons that carry EPHB with with the areas of high degree of FND. So the Photoshop, the PowerPoint sometimes tells me time to move on. So of course, as a physicist, my first approach to this problem is to define the Hamiltonian. And I'll first talk about the mapping of horizontal axis and the retina on this axis, anterior posterior axis of the superior colliculus. And here, since there is a chemorepulsion between axons and the surrounding medium, the idea here is to define a functional that will minimize the number, that will be equal to the number of bound receptors and ligands. Right, so the idea is that this system of projections will minimize the overall number of receptors that are bound by the ligand in the target. And this is just from like simple version of mass action law. It's the product of receptor carried by the axon times the ligand at the place where axon terminates. And then there is a sum of all axons that are actually innervating this target. And the problem with this functional, of course, is that all axons, since they're repelled, if this is the level of the ligand, all axons would want to terminate at the place where the level of ligand is minimum. So then you have to postulate that there is a competition between axons for space. So axons actually are not point-like. They have a finite area that they can occupy, and they will therefore face this problem of competition from their peers. And the axons that are most desperate, that have the highest level of EPHA, will end up, as a result of minimizing this functional, at the bottom of this ramp defined by the ligand. And the least sensitive neurons to the ligand will end up on top of the of this ramp. As a result, this topographic map of the correct orientation will be established. Unfortunately, it's the mirror reflection of this coordinate, anterior posterior. So it's basically, it has to be mirror reflected. So this is the coordinate in the target of an axon. So the axons will, the temporal axons from the temporal eye, part of the eye, will terminate an anterior part of the target and so on. Well, similarly, you can define the part of the functional that is of this Hamiltonian that controls the mapping along the vertical axis and the eye. In this case, remember there was a chemo attraction, so therefore I have to change the sign. I have to add a minus sign, and then the idea would be that the this part of the functional will be the receptor on an axon multiplied by the ligand at the position where the axon terminates. And then the product of those two will give me the overall number of ligands that activate, of receptors that is activated by the axon, by the ligand. And as a result of optimization, I will have axons that have high level of receptor terminating at positions with high level of ligand. The units here are absorbed in those coefficients, but I can actually find from the beta, I can find that those, the levels, how they're distributed. You can actually find by... It's the concept. So R is the concentration of receptor at the axon surface. Yeah. It's a concentration of ligand in the medium where the axon grows.
And it's a surface concentration?
Yeah, it's a surface because they interact with the surface. Those are surface-bound proteins. So it is actually a measurable quantity. The only thing is that is not clear is what is the absolute units for those. And I'm assuming that they are absorbed in those coefficients. And I can actually find those coefficients from feeds to the data.
What
is being optimized is the connectivity matrix between the eye and the target, and the connectivity matrix is actually hidden in those coordinates. So this is actually a connectivity matrix. It's the position of axon number A in the target.
Why it
has nothing to do with energy. Actually, it's a Hamiltonian, yes, but we define it as a potential. We call it potential. We don't call it energy. I guess it's the trick which I learned from Eugene Shakhnovich that you can basically generalize some behavior of amino acids and then call there's something called functional potential.
Connectivity matrix?
It's basically where which axon goes. It can go here, it can go here, it can go here. And the connectivity matrix is this, actually. It's the position of the axon number A that comes out from there in the target.
Is there time in this curve, in the sense that some neurons will be right there before others, or?
So the way it happens is that it's a very good question, actually. So there is maybe 60% of what we do is timing issue, and different species they have differences in timing. This mapping mechanism is conserved between species to the fish basically, to the level of fish, and the from humans to fish. So the idea is that in mammals, what happens is that axons they grow through the target, and then they will initially, and then they will start projecting everywhere in the target. They will produce trial branches. And then the trial branches will converge at the right spot. So in the mammals, it's a good approximation to assume that the initial map is random. Whereas in, say, frogs, the axons will grow more directly towards the place where they're supposed to be.
A completely random map, which is gradually being optimized to lower that function.
Yes, I'll show you the movie, actually. So what you see here is the same a set of axons. And what you can see here, the blue shows the level of receptor in the target as the system, as the mapping evolves towards the optimal map. And this is the level of receptor EPHB, which is responsible for vertical mapping, for exactly the same set of axons. As you can see, the axons, because they're chemoattracted to F and B, they gather at the top of the target, and these are, because they're chemorepelled from F and B, they gather at the...
Do we have to worry about the entangling of the axons?
It's a very good question, which is yet unresolved. I mean, this particular thing operates just on the weight matrix. I mean, it's basically beyond my comprehension at this point. I think the idea is that they're not entangled, and the idea is that axons, they grow in such a way that they can rearrange themselves.
Yeah, I thought I was worrying about the depth of the oxygen on the surface. Is everything dense and just changing, or is it in the loop region where there's plenty of space?
Oh, they're dense. They're extremely densely packed, yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, so what I just told you is that because there was a map, I was able to use a gradient to form this connectivity. So I actually formed 1 megapixel of connections with 4 labels. So this kind of mechanisms. Maps, actually, the functional significance of maps may be to save on the space of the genome to encode the connectivity. So that's one of the possible philosophical conclusions from this. So neurons are not just cells. They don't just express proteins. They also carry information about the stimuli. So they have this electric activity, which is spikes or action potentials. So how can that enter into play? So this is during the development of this map, the eyes of the mouse is actually closed. So, but the retina of the mouse generates its own stimuli. So it sort of pre-trains the visual system for the instant of prepares for the eye-opening experience that will happen 1 week later. And the those are the images that you can record from the retina of the mouse by extracting the retina from the animal and putting it on electron arrays. There are 512 electrodes here. As you can see, there are waves propagating on the retina. They are spread up by a factor of 4, so I can finish my talk in time. And this is the form of activity that actually is important for formation of those maps. So what is the effect of correlated activity? In this image, what you can see is that this group injected a tracer in the eye, and then it diffused into the target, and then it formed very, very tight termination zone, which, because the map is very nice and precise, right? But this happens in normal mouse. But if you disrupt a retinal wave by a genetic manipulation, the projection, the same injection, leads to a much more diffuse projection, which means that the map is less precise. So there is a substantial effect of those waves on sharpening of the connections. And of course, again, as a physicist, I want to include this in my Hamiltonian as just additional factor. So there is a big leap of faith that the interaction between those chemical factors that I described before and the effects of correlated activity are actually additive. And therefore, we call it additive model for activity. The idea for this term is that it basically plays the role of gravity between axons. So the CIJ, there are two axons. It's a pairwise interaction between axons, I and J, and there is a CIJ is the degree of correlation between axons due to this activity, and this is actually a measurable quantity that you can measure from those recordings, multiple electrode arrays. And this is the form factor for the function that describes you the degree of interaction between axons, and it's a function of the distance between axons. And it is actually determined, this form factor is determined by the horizontal connections in the target. So we just assume that, for simplicity, that this is a Gaussian, has a Gaussian form. You could argue that, I mean, we derive it actually from Hebbian learning rules, so-called, but you could argue that this sort of function implements classical Pavlovian conditioning. The idea would be that if one axon represents the buzz, another one represents the food, those two axons want to be close to each other so that they will activate the neurons that control the release of saliva in the dog, Pavlovian dog. Another way to motivate this form of interaction is to say that this is sort of a cluster expansion of the Hamiltonian. So you have the first term is just product of receptor times ligand at the place where the receptor terminates, and the second term is basically a pairwise pairwise correlation between axons multiplied by a pairwise function for the pair of axons. So unfortunately, despite the fact that it looks like a classical gravity or classical electrostatics form of interaction, it is this correlation function is not separable. So you cannot introduce an electric potential. So it makes things a little bit more complicated. So what happens if one introduces this correlated activity term? So the correlated activity is basically attraction between axons that have that have large correlations between their electric spikes. And so this is the retina. This is the theorist's view of retina. It's square. And then there is a red area in the retina that I'm going to trace. Right? So if there is no attraction, then it forms a diffuse cloud in the target. Those red axons in the target of superior colliculus, they all form a diffuse cloud. And the map is kind of bumpy. So this is the point here will represent by color where it originates in the retina. If I increase, ramp up the attraction between axons, they will gradually coalesce into almost precise image of the circle in the retina of the origin, which means that attraction between axons with same or similar correlated activity leads to sharpening of the map, similarly to what is observed experimentally. So we postulated that maybe this additive model between effects of chemical labels and correlated activity may be reasonable. So how can one test this hypothesis? Well, the idea actually came after looking at the results of this experiment, in which the labels, the chemical labels that I discussed before, they were removed. So in normal eye, if I inject a tracer in the eye, it will generate a spot in superior colliculus. But what happens if I remove the topographic labels that I described in the first part of the talk? Is that this diffuse spot will break out into small pieces. Each piece will include several axons. But the complete picture is not available about what happens. So we can actually do the complete picture. It costs us nothing to remove one of the labels, and this is what the form of map that we see, we call it the broken mirror map. So this is, again, the retina. The color code represents position in the retina. And in the target, when one of the labels, the horizontal label, is removed, you observe those domains. Within the domains, the coordinate, the retinal coordinate for those cells changes smoothly. But there is no global order of the global ordering in the domains. So the reason why you have this patchiness is because, for example, if you inject into the blue area in the retina, you will observe that this blue area in the target is split into three points, and that is similar to. Also, I mean, the number of points in which the number of domains per point can be actually random from 1 to 5. So we suggest that actually if you are able to obtain the complete structure of the topographic map, you will see something like this mirror map. And this experiment was actually done a year later by the group of David Feldheim in UC Santa Cruz. And the idea was that to basically do this imaging, this is called intrinsic imaging of topographic map. And as you can see here, there is indeed in those animals where the markers, the topographic markers are removed, there are those domains formed. And if you move along this line in the target superior colliculus, you will see that retinal coordinates sometimes change abruptly and substantially. So this sort of experiment implicitly suggests that the additive model for topographic map formation is not so crazy. And the idea is that the reason why it is important that is because the idea here is that the correlated neural activity, because it's attraction between neurons, it will form topography within the domains. But because it's a short-range attraction, it cannot form the global ordering. And the global, to form the global ordering, you need those topographic labels. And if you remove the topographic labels, the global ordering is destroyed. But you still have those domains that are within which you have small islands of topographic order. I just want to summarize this because I'll go through the next several models fast. So the idea here is that there is a global ordering of axons that is provided by those molecular gradients. And there is a refinement which occurs locally by the effects of correlated activity. And those two different types of ordering are represented by two terms in the Hamiltonian. So the next sort of map in the degree of complexity is the ocular dominance map. It's a mixture of two eyes. And again, this is the example of the ocular dominance maps. This is what we have. The left and right eye are not mixed uniformly. They form domains. The periodicity of those domains is about 2 millimeters. And this is a very exotic example of the same structure where the third eye was introduced to the frog, to the tadpole. And you can actually surgically introduce it, and the axons will grow, and they will innervate an optic tectum, which is analog of superior colliculus in higher vertebrates. So what you can see here are the stripes, which are stripes of the third eye in the area occupied by the native eye. So in the frog, the tectum of frog is dominated by a single eye. So normally, in normal frog, this would be completely white. But when the ectopic axons arrive to tectum, they will form those stripes. The surprising thing here is that this is sort of a gain of function experiment in which you put something new to animal that has never been evolutionarily exposed to this problem of demixing set of axons. So it's completely new for this animal. Oops.
I'm confused. Two eyes with white and black. Three eyes with three colors, but we still have two colors.
It's a very good question, yeah. So the idea is that in the frog, the one half of the brain is dominated by one eye. So in us, in primates, a half of the brain is always dominated by two eyes. In the frogs, normally, this would be white. There is only one eye, and there is another half, which has another eye, right? So the third color is actually in the other hemisphere. And then they put the optic nerve of the new, of the surgically introduced eye on the native eye, on one of the eyes, and they will grow to the tectum, and they will innervate it. And
because two eyes were not overlapping before, when you put third one overlaps with four.
With one of them.
One.
Yeah. Which one? I don't know, left or right. I have no idea. I'm showing you half of the brain.
Huh? Just always one or four?
It's always one. So you have one hemisphere is dominated. So it happens that in the frog they cross. The right eye goes here completely, and this eye goes there completely. Right. The third eye, and it will grow with one of the eyes, and here they will mix, but only into one. In humans, actually, you have both eyes going in both directions. So that's why in humans and primates and cats. You have in mammals, not in rodents, you have this kind of structure. So this is interesting. I mean, there must be some basic mechanism that allows for this naive system to form some high-level structure. So we basically, I mean, it's also easy to do it in the same model, and we take the, what you do is you take two eyes, right, with the same distribution of chemical labels. Just duplicate the distribution of chemical labels. But there are correlations, there are interactions between axons in the target. And you assume that I1 interacts with I1 and I2 interacts with I2, but there is no correlation in activity between I1 and I2. Because they can only be localized to one eye. They cannot propagate to another eye. Right? And then you put them into mix, and this is what they form. They form structure that is very similar to ocular dominance. So, the reason why it's formed is actually is this. So you have, if you just have only chemical label, the eyes will mix uniformly, and therefore will form salt and pepper type of structure. And this is because they don't care, the chemical labels don't care which eye you came from. But because you have this attraction by due to correlated activity, you have you have those domains. The domains are formed because these axons are attracted to each other, but they're not attracted to these neurons. And you can actually calculate the periodicity of the structure. Unfortunately, the previous speaker already stole my 1/3 power formula. So this is my 1/3. Right. So the idea is that you can calculate basically the energy that is introduced by the interface, and this neuron will have to pay energy, which is the fraction, which scales with the wavelength of the structure, is 1/λ, because this is the fraction of neurons that are actually on the interface. But also, this neuron to arrive to this point, it will have to be displaced. So it goes from its optimal position from point of view of chemical labels. So you can think of being attached with a tether to the optimal position due to chemical labels. So it will actually the cost associated with the number squared. So the result of balancing have 1/3. We are trying to think about how to test this formula. It's not still untested. I would like to talk. I have about 5 minutes left, maybe less. About olfactory maps. That's the most exciting part that we're actually doing right now. And there are new developments that are experimental and are trying to address them. So this is the problem of olfactory map. You have olfactory genomes. Humans have about 850 genes. Most of them are pseudogenes, so we have about 350 genes that are intact, and they can lead to production of protein. Those are proteins which can bind odorants and translate this information to cells. Right. So those are proteins. In mouse, there are about 1,200 genes that are intact, and so on. So the problem of the map. So I'm going to argue that the same model as I described you right now can be applied to olfactory map formation. So there is sort of a universal rule for forming this type of maps. So the idea is that the axons actually reside in the nasal cavity. You can see this cross section, the beautiful nasal cavity of the mouse. And they reside, the cell bodies are in the nasal cavity, and they're exposed to the odorants. And then they have to grow, and they have to target some places in the brain region that is called olfactory bulb. Okay? So the rule is this, that each axon, each cell, it's called receptor neuron, will pick one receptor, one protein to generate. It will pick it stochastically out of 1,000. Okay, so therefore they become different colors. They have white neurons, they're yellow neurons, and so on. Right, so there are 1,000 types of neurons. Each type of neuron is about 10,000 cells. And then when they grow, they have to terminate at the point in the olfactory bulb that is called the glomerulus. The glomerulus is basically a synaptic sac that takes the information from receptor neurons and sends it to the brain. But the interesting point is that all neurons which are dispersed in nasal cavity, they converge to a single point in the bulb. So it's not clear. It's unknown how it happens. How do they find this position? And this is I'm going to argue that you can use the same model as the visual system. So this is the same thing. So this is mouse olfactory receptor 28, that all the receptor neuron axons, they converge on a single glomerulus. And glomeruli, actually, they are sacs about 100 microns in diameter, and they are densely packed on the surface of olfactory bulb. You can see only one here, but there are about 10,000 per. There are about 2,000 per half. So this is what I'm going to tell you is that basically the projection from the olfactory epithelium to olfactory bulb is mostly the crude projection is controlled by the gradient. So there are similar sets of gradients. Instead of four molecules, you have six. Okay, but the idea is basically the same, that you have gradients that allow you to crudely navigate to your correct spot. But then you also have those activity-dependent mechanisms, but they act in a weird way. So the activity-dependent mechanisms, they actually, what they do, the activity forces the cell to express certain protein at certain level. So it doesn't act directly on the connections. It just instructs the cell to produce certain protein. And there are three sets of proteins that are dependent on activity. There are chirals, there are efferents, and there's a BIK2 receptor and with unknown ligand. So, and those activity-dependent proteins, they have so-called mosaic distribution in the target olfactory bulb. So this is the surface of olfactory bulb with a bunch of glomeruli, and you can see that chirals, they have this mosaic discrete discontinuous distribution, and actually those two receptors are anti-correlated. So, and the model basically is the same with some interesting twist. The idea is that there are those receptors, right, so they interact. These chirals are homophilic, they control homophilic attraction. So the axons, they have the same level of chiral, they will be strongly driven to each other, and so on. So you have this interaction term, but now the interaction is chiral, for example, on one axon with chiral on another axon, and there is this interaction term. So instead of, again, you have this electrostatic kind of interaction, but now the charge term, which was the correlation between axons, becomes separable. So you have basically it's equal to the product of two levels on two axons. So therefore, it becomes more electrostatic. You can actually introduce electrostatic potential. But the interesting part is that there are actually three different types of receptors. So you have a separate electrostatic interaction for every one of those three types. So you have something that we call chromostatic, right? But because you can introduce the electrostatic analog, of course, electrostatic potential, it becomes much faster. Because if you want to implement it for computer, it's much faster. It's a much faster implementation. These are basically preliminary data when you have, the idea is that the receptors are distributed quasi-randomly in the nasal cavity, but they can placed into the space, which is called receptor space, based on those smooth gradients, right? Although they are in physical space, they are mixed, but in the gradient space, you can actually place, and those are different receptor cells. And then you can color them with colors, which is this chromostatic interaction charge. Chiral, EPH, BIK2, and if you start off from this kind of arrangement, you will arrive. You will see the glomeruli which are formed in the target. And the interesting twist here is that it turns out that this arrangement actually has to respect the coloring constraint, because if you have two colors, two charged charged colors which are next to each other, then the glomeruli will be mixed. So we're claiming basically that the evolution somehow solved the coloring problem in this receptor space, which is incomplete, which is, I think, amazing. So the conclusion is that the additive model for genes and experience seems to work fine on the bottom of the visual system and olfactory system. Interactions between axons of olfactory neurons obey chromostatic law, and the arrangement of receptor neurons in the receptor space may actually satisfy the coloring, solve the coloring problem. And these are my collaborators and funding. Thank you.
I would like to go back to Boris's question. If you have lines that are attached to one plane somewhere, mm-hmm. some random points, then go to another plane and first attached sort of randomly, and then try to rearrange. Unless you have some topo or something else that cuts and lets them through, the system is the worst possible topological nightmare. And how would, and it's worse than entangled linear polymers, it's worse than stars. It's almost exponential to find to unentangle it. So how would your process be able to connect?
I agree completely with you, and I don't know how to resolve this problem. The way experimentally what is known about it is that what happens with axons, how they solve this problem, is that when in mammals, for example, they arrive to the brain area and then they grow until they basically grow straight. They grow straight and then they start produce branches, side branches. that are targeting, first they produce side branches everywhere along the length, and then they start converging onto the correct spot. So there is no entanglement. I mean, if they just, if axons are just sticks, they cannot
entangle. They don't mechanically move, instead they grow into different places. They retract what they...
Could you explain a little bit better why you can map interactions on the electrostatic interactions? What is actually there interacting? Do you mean some charges on the axons?
No, there is no charges.
No. So pulses are interacting.
Yeah.
The pulses are interacting.
So the idea is that if mm-hmm. the pulse comes in and it will drive a cell, and then there is another cell that comes in and it has a correlated set of pulses,
yeah.
The synapses will be stabilized. And this is just an observed, you can quantify it.
But the pulses, they don't go continuously, they are discrete, right,
yeah.
These pulses.
Yeah.
So these interactions will turn on and turn off. And it was not seen in the Johann Antonio, it looked like a static one.
The idea is that, that's a very good point. The idea is that this modification of synapses occurs very, very slowly. So it averages, it may go on for a day, for example. And the fluctuations in activity, they have scales of seconds. So there is quite a bit of averaging going on. That's why I can replace this correlation matrix. I think I can replace the correlation matrix with just a static correlation matrix. But there's definitely a lot of dynamics going on because the actually 10 times more synapses are produced than retained. So most of them are dead.
So maybe we have time for one last question. Nobody else asked it? Then I'll ask. So you said that there's activity. There is activity dependent remapping. So there are presumably experiments where one eye is shut or the animal somehow tortured early on. And then this clumping does not occur?
The ocular dominance pattern, what happens is, for example, if you close the left eye, the periodicity will be roughly the same, but it will, the right eye area will increase, and the left eye area will shrink. So the stripe will become thinner, which corresponds to the deprived eye, and the stripe that is undeprived will expand.
But this is a little strange because I thought you said that without that correlated activity remapping, you would get a somewhat diffuse distribution, right? Which then, I think you described it as clumping.
Yeah.
But now you actually block the input from one eye, but it is still clumped.
I understand the.
But is it just because even without external input, there is some sort of
spontaneous
firing
that's going on? And you basically have spontaneous activity plus you have stimuli. So if you remove stimuli, you have less attraction for the eye.
But you can presumably also block spontaneous activity by some greater violence. Okay. Well, one last question? Okay, 30 seconds.
You explained the periodicity for two eyes, and there was also the main, if you remove the anchors, there was also the main structure. How do you drive the length scale of those domains?
It's extremely interesting, and experimentally, if I do a computer experiment, it's the same as the range of interactions. But there is a large coefficient, and if I start hitting it, there is a divergence. Before there is a divergence, there's a critical phenomenon. Before they become completely diffused,
you want to set up?
There is a the scale, length scale of them diverges approximately as the square root. And I think so, yeah. But I don't really know how the how it's all. I don't understand it completely. So. Thank you.
Okay, let's thank Alex again.
So it's actually working. So we're going to switch subjects rapidly, and let's find you know, and you can hear me. Our next speaker is Ida Cassell, and population